Welcome to Real Stories, a show that has honest conversations from the heart. I invite you to sit back, relax, and allow our guests to speak their truth.
Hello, I'm Taylor, the communication doctor, and welcome to Real Stories. I just want to say, I come from a family where people didn't always speak their truth. And I think it's so important to speak their truth. And every day I meet people who, because of society, are just walking with that facade because they feel that it is the way to be. And in Real Stories, I want people to know the real story behind the facade. And that is why I do what I do. Hello, this is Real Stories, and I am your host, Talia, the Communication Doctor. And today on my show, I have Marsha Ranroop. And Marsha Ranroop is a diversity and inclusion cultural intelligence facilitator and trainer for her company, which is called Unheard Voice. Hello, Marsha.
Hello there, Tanya. Thanks so much for inviting me to take part in your podcast.
Oh, you know what? I'm so excited to speak to you today because the power of your name, Unheard Voice, or the company's name, really connects with me, especially as I call myself a communication doctor. And I want to learn a little bit more than that. And I think that's where my first question goes. Number one, why the name Unheard Voice? And tell me a little bit more about what that actually means and what you actually do.
Well, I have always worked in journalism and I've always striven to work in communities and reach people and get their stories told as far and as widely as possible. And always I have had the sort of personal work motto to give the unheard voice a place to speak. And I was going about doing my journalism and I was in some leadership training and I had the opportunity to share some insight around diversity and inclusion. And one of my colleagues on that leadership course said, Marsha, I really think you need to go into private practice and provide training and consultancy around diversity and inclusion. And I was like, really? And he said, yeah, you've got the knowledge, you know, you should go and do it. And I knew in that moment that I was going to call my company Unheard Voice. And so when the course was over on the Friday, the Saturday morning, I got up, I logged onto the computer and I bought the domain name unheardvoice.co.uk and Unheard Voice Consultancy is the name of the company. And my motto on there is giving the unheard voice a place to speak. Because it's not about me, it's not about who I am. It's about ultimately people in our society who are facing inequality and discrimination and how all of us in as individuals, teams, organisations and society can go about being better, making sure we listen and we hear those that we don't currently listen to.
Oh, you know what? I think that's absolutely brilliant. And I really resonate with the whole point of actually listening to people because you're so right, in our society, we don't listen. And with the whole diverse and inclusion and the whole cultural intelligence thing, it's so important because a lot of people just lack that awareness. But I want to go a little bit deeper in terms of your personal story. And I want to have a look at, you said, you know, you called yourself Unheard, your company Unheard Voices. Have you ever felt unheard? Or was there a moment in your life where you really felt unheard? And what was that moment?
Yeah, so I think we all have our ups and downs in our, you know, personal work lives. But I've always been a person who had a huge amount of confidence in myself. And that's something that my parents gave me growing up. They believed in me. I knew I wanted to work in radio and journalism. They supported me to do that. And, you know, every step of the way, I really believed in myself and achieved my dreams. And then one day, I really thought I hit the big time because in my organisation, something that never normally happened to me. And that was, I was approached, I was headhunted for a senior leadership role. Brilliant. And I thought, I was completely blown away by this opportunity. I thought, oh my goodness, finally, after all these many years of hard work, all those struggles that I've had, all the things I've been told previously about not being good enough and all these other things, it's finally come to fruition, you know, I'm being recognised. So rather blindly, I think, I said, yes, of course I'll do the job. It was a promotion, it was more money, it was much, much further away from home than I had previously worked, but, you know, my husband and I decided to make it work. And I started to work in this new place. And the mentor who had brought me in and was championing me, about a few months after I started, she left. And that's when what I describe was when the knives came out. Oh. And the person who then replaced her sort of sank those knives in a little bit deeper, and subsequently gave me a lot of difficult work to do without any support. And the whole thing caused me to have a mental health breakdown. But the trigger was there was a staff survey. And the outcome of that staff survey was apparently that Marsha was never going to live up to the way she was recruited. And when those attitudes were voiced in that way, the new manager validated these attitudes and said that I had to turn the team's perception of me around rather than the manager herself tackling the underlying prejudice behind the sentiment. And, you know, I outlined all the different ways I was facing harassing, bullying, repeated undermining behaviours and attitudes from the people who were sort of wielding the knives, shall we say. And when I raised those issues with her, she didn't manage them. So after a series of mental health breakdowns, actually, as it turned out, I had an occupational health assessment, which advised the manager to carry out a risk assessment of, you know, my situation, which was never done. I was in the same situation as I was before. So I then suffered the most horrendous anxiety attack, and I stopped going into work. I was signed off. So I decided I had a choice. Well, I had three choices. The choice was try to apply for a different job. But given the mental health state I was in, I was not being successful at applying for other roles. I could stay, but that didn't seem to be a very good idea either, given the stress and distress it was causing me. Or I could leave. So I thought, well, I have to leave. And so I ended up calling the person who was my original mentor and said, look, I'm going to leave. Can you be a referee on my CV? And she said, don't leave. Clearly, you know, you're not really in any state to make that kind of decision. Just take your time and don't do anything. And then unbeknownst to me, she intervened at a much higher level. And she got me lifted out of that situation. However, I was then told subsequently that I needed to return to that situation, at which point I put in a grievance with my employer at the time. And the grievance was around me facing these bullying, harassing, repeated undermining behaviours, that the attitude around the fact that I was never going to live up to the way I was recruited was prejudicial, and that my managers had a duty to protect me, and they didn't do that. So anyway, I went through the very traumatic process of going through the grievance procedure, and the outcome came that, well, actually, I will quote to you what the outcome was, and it was this. The hearing manager said, what I heard from you and the managers that she heard from leads me to conclude that environment there can be insular and hostile to outsiders. While this doesn't affect everybody in the same way, and it predates your current manager's appointment, I recommend that she and other managers address this. It's their responsibility to ensure that everybody who works in that place feels that they have a place regardless of where they come from and how they were appointed. It's not easy, and these attitudes are likely entrenched, but it cannot be the sole responsibility of new people into a team to fit in. This goes against the organisation's aims to diversify its workforce and output. So that was the outcome. That was the concluding paragraph. However, my grievance was not upheld. And I read that paragraph and I didn't understand how can my grievance not be upheld when that is the complaint I was making. And she's agreed with that my complaint had foundation. So then I went through the whole emotional trauma all over again of an appeal, and it was still found that there wasn't grounds on which to uphold the appeal. So of course that then caused me another mental health breakdown. And I took a great deal of work in self-management to be able to come through that and say, well, these are circumstances outside of me. I really believe in, I have to believe in myself. But I have to say that whole process, which took a couple of years of my life, stripped me quite fully of most of my confidence and self-esteem.
You know, and I'm just going to intervene there, Marsha, because there is so much there. And I just want to say, of course, it would strip you of your confidence and your self-esteem, because just as I'm listening to you, you said a couple of things. You went back to when you were working with a mentor and the knives came out, and then this whole trigger and this cause of your mental health and the burnout and all of this stuff that really affected you in the anxiety attacks. I totally can understand that, but I just want to go back a little bit, because I just want to find out, because what you didn't quite explain when you said the knives came out was what actually happened. So obviously this person has said that she feels you don't live up to the role that you were employed to do. And I think you're amazing, so I know that's absolute rubbish. But I just want to get a sense of, before the knives came out, what was said, what kind of happened? Tell me a little bit more about that story that caused all of this pain, anxiety and mental health breakdown.
Well, on an ongoing basis, it's sort of the little things that really build up. So yeah. Not turning up to meetings that I would arrange, literally standing up in the office and shouting at me. Wow. Walking out of meetings giving me dressing downs, asking other team members to do things which then didn't include me but affected the way that I was working, quite clear poor behaviours that most people would then address and indeed discipline over. But I was told that I was the problem, that I needed to fix myself.
Fascinating. That's total. Especially when you say the shouting, that's total disrespect, walking out of meetings.
Yes.
And really, I don't think anyone should be able to put up with this. Now, just to kind of get in, because obviously you do the cultural intelligence and you do the diversity inclusion. Mm. Now, do you feel that this was a racial experience, in terms of experience of racism or prejudice in some way?
I think that the people who were involved in being undermining and harassing and bullying and so on, I think there was an element of race and unconscious bias in the way that they were behaving, but they generally behaved in that way towards other people as well.
Okay.
So it wouldn't necessarily just have been down to that. What I did think was the racial element was when I approached my managers to manage it, they said that I was the problem. And that is like a typical response when a woman of colour goes into an organisation, she sees issues, she calls them out for what they are. It is often turned around to be that the person of colour's problem, especially women of colour in organisations. It's a well-known reaction, especially within white leadership, for that to happen. And consequently, you know, exactly the same things that happened to me have happened as they are foreseen to happen, and this is repeated behaviour that happens throughout organisations, women of colour calling out issues and then being told that they're the problem.
You know what, I totally resonate with you there, totally resonate with you, and I've seen it happen a lot with various different organisations, and it is so interesting obviously that you're doing this work. How do you feel that your issue would have been dealt with if you were a white woman? Just as a hearsay, well, plain devil's advocate.
Yeah, it's very difficult to know, to be honest. I do think it would have been dealt with differently. I think the fact that I raised race as a concern within my grievance was why it was dismissed, because no organisation wants to admit that they've got a problem with racism.
Yes.
And it would have been damning themselves, shooting themselves in the foot to say that they have. And this is and it's been really eye opening for me to realise that the difficulties that I've had in terms of, you know, in my work life, trying to reach out to communities and facing those barriers to get those stories told, was something bigger than me not just doing my job properly. And it's like the scales have fallen from my eyes, and that's why I feel diversity and inclusion is not what I want to do, it's what I need to do.
Love that.
You know, what I want to do is work in radio and be a journalist and you know, lead teams to be better, you know, at telling stories. But there is something much more fundamental around the understanding about giving people those voices that needs to change, and that is a societal problem, and one that needs to be tackled head on. And if I can find a way to do that better, then I want to do it. And that's where the cultural intelligence comes in, because you know, we bash people over the head and say, do diversity and inclusion better, but we don't tell them how, because it's clear that you know, the business case, for want of a better word, has been well made for the last 30 years. There's a report going back to 1990 which talks about the business case of diversity and inclusion. So people know why it needs to be done, they know what it should look like, but they don't know how. And that's what cultural intelligence does. It's a very clear step-by-step process to move people from awareness to action. The research behind it, they ask the question, what is the difference between those that are successful at working in globalized multicultural environments and those that fail? Which is a great question. What's the difference between success and failure in working with people who are different from you? And they came up with all the research they did with tens of thousands of people. They nailed it down to four capabilities that individuals need. The first capability is drive. And if you think about it, if you're going to embark on any kind of change, you've got to want to do it. You've got to be motivated.
Totally.
And so if you've got the first capability, CQ drive. CQ is cultural quotient. It's a measurement that cultural intelligence has come up with. And we'll explain a bit more about it in a second. The second capability is knowledge. What do you need to know? What are you thinking about when you're embarking on working with people who are different from you? The third capability is strategy, CQ strategy. What are you thinking about? What you're thinking about is metacognition. It's a unique human ability to think about what you're thinking about. Take a step back, check your assumptions. Are you planning for those interactions with thoughtful process, and are you self-aware of your own unconscious bias? And the final capability is CQ action, because ultimately people judge you on your behaviour, how you're adapting, not adapting, your voice, your tone, your personal space that you give people. And if you have those four capabilities and you want to improve them and you want to get better, be better at working with people who are different from you and ultimately create cultures of inclusion.
You know what? This is fascinating. And also I'm really excited because I know I did your cultural intelligence course and I thought it was absolutely fascinating. And it is interesting also from the point of perception. I think you kind of touched on it when you said, you know, the whole need to know and the strategies, and it's knowing the reason why you need to do this cultural intelligence course and the diversity and the inclusion and how you can make those changes. But it's quite interesting even just looking at, you know, how we look at the Japanese, for example, you know, the differences in the cultural interaction, the differences in how we connect with people from that cultural space. And it's absolutely fascinating. And obviously, it's obvious to me why you do this work. And you said that you feel that you have to do this work. It's not that you necessarily went into it accidentally because you thought, my God, there's a need. And especially you being a Black woman, there's a need for you to be heard. There's a need for us to kind of change some of these perceptions, because a lot of us have perceptions of each other and those perceptions may not be true. And that's when we'll be getting to this misunderstanding and the whole unconscious bias thing as well. It's just, in these terms, I just find them really fascinating, really, how they're just coming out. I want to ask you something. This is just kind of on the thing in terms of what you think about some of these labels, though, because obviously you do all this work. I'm just being totally honest with you, just because I'm talking to you about this, I have a real problem with this label of BAME. Now, the reason I have a problem with this BAME label is because I feel like, especially like in big organisations, there'll be like a pocket of money and they'll say, okay, we'll use this for the BAME society. But for me, I think it just enforces even more segregation, and it enforces even more kind of separation and separating us as kind of people rather than people coming together. And then they're having a reason to do things rather than actually just seeing you, maybe say if it was you, Marsha, or if I seen you, Marsha, as a woman who is capable of doing this amazing job on radio and getting that promotion because of what you can do rather than because of being within the BAME bracket. What do you think about that word BAME?
Well, I think that one of the issues around diversity and inclusion is that we approach it in a very siloed way. So, we're going to make sure that we treat people who are homosexual in this way over here, and we'll treat women, make sure we're looking at women over here, and we're making sure that we're doing something about disability over here, making sure we're doing something about race over there. And this siloing of difference is one of my big bugbears. And that includes using the term BAME, BME, because ultimately diversity is as diverse as every individual in the world. And everyone comes from their own perspectives, their own values, their own ways that they, you know, the lens that they come from. And that is completely intersectional. And we cannot use a label, because labels that we might offer, even using the law, do not necessarily resonate with the way an individual might want to identify themselves.
Yes.
And that's why it's very important when we're talking about diversity and inclusion, we talk about individuals and what we need to do to change our own behaviours, policies, structures and attitudes, rather than, you know, what we're doing to help that group over there or this group over here. So, and that's why I think the cultural intelligence approach is so important, because it takes into account cultural norms. So, for example, you talked about Japan And you'd say, well, a cultural norm in Japan might be that they are very hierarchical. So if you're working in a Japanese organization, you're more likely to need to look to your boss to verify your decision, rather than if you worked at Google, where it's more egalitarian and you can probably, you know, make a decision and just tell them that you've made it. And those kind of value differences may exist, but that's not to say all Japanese people are like that. There are Japanese people who work at Google and, you know, can quite happily exist within a less of a hierarchy. So it's understanding, okay, there are some archetypes, there are some norms, but you mustn't act in a stereotypical way based on you know, what you perceive a label to be, because of course the Black experience is different from the Asian experience, which is different from the traveler experience. Exactly. But there are joint experiences in that you can be viewed that the patriarchy do lump people together and treat them equally in discriminatory way, and that's those are the rights that have been fought for. So there are some group you know, identifiers, if you like, but identity is down to an individual, and labels don't always help.
You know what, I want to clap right now, because I'm just sat back listening to you, everything you just said there with regards to, you know, the labels, because I, as I said, I absolutely hate the labels and how society views us, and we can go down many, many different roads there, because there is so much within cultural intelligence to talk about, and within patriarchy and the whole the whole kettle of fish. But basically what I kind of want to say is that is it. We are all unique beings, and we should be judged for what we do and how we are, rather than it being a cultural thing and actually having a label that's put on with us. While it would be so lovely if we could come to this world and people could just see you for who you are as a person and build that relationship and get to know you for who you are, and you being employed because of what you can do. And I know there's this whole thing with the CV, and it's interesting now we've got LinkedIn or social media, because, and obviously you can see this as a Black person or white person, that there could be even more kind of things with perceptions. And I bet there's some people that walk into a room and have those perceptions in the first 3 seconds when they see somebody, unless they do a talk or they do something, can you think, oh, I didn't realize that person and me have so much in common. And I think that sometimes breaks us away as people, because I always find that, you know, I talk to somebody and there may be so much serendipity between me and that person. So for example, it could be me and a white male in the room that really connect, that have got the same kind of, you know, background and been brought up in the same place. He could have been brought up around, you know, a Jamaican culture. You just don't know. You don't know until you talk to people, until you resonate, until you build those relationships. And I feel that's why this is so powerful, because we just, I suppose there's a movement there where we just need to change these perceptions of people, and the labels are just making it worse. And that's what I feel.
Yeah, absolutely, I do agree.
So it's just so lovely to talk to you. Just to go a little bit deep, because I said, you obviously you talked about your experience, you talked about the mental health, you talked about your breakthrough. How did you overcome that? So I'm going back and forth there, but I just want to come back just to kind of round it off in terms of there being light at the end of the tunnel with this story, because I do feel there is in some way in terms of the work that you do now. But how did you overcome that for anybody that may be going through that right now, in terms of the way that you look at that situation now?
Well, it's amazing, actually. I never really believed at the time that I would look at it in the way that I do now, but it was an incredible learning experience for me. The way I was able to come through it was three things. Amazing support from my husband, my mum, and friends. And without that, especially my husband, I mean, he's just an amazing guy, and I'm so lucky to have him in my life. Yeah. So that's number one.
Brilliant.
Second was, help with seeking mental health support. And I was lucky to be able to access NHS services, which provided me with counselling and CBT. Mm. And thirdly, I think somewhere deep down, I just dug into my resilience. I found it somewhere. I think as a result of those other two things, when that started coming back, I, used the processes in CBT to try to turn around my thoughts and realise it wasn't me. I wasn't the issue here. There's something fundamentally at play here, which I needed to take control of. And I think taking control of the things I could take control of is what's really, really helped me. And knowing what's important, realizing, reassessing, where work was in my life and the amount of effort and emotional investment that I had in it, that reassessing that and looking at things differently has been hugely helpful. And for me, I never really believed the impact of mental health issues before. I would have said to someone who was going through what I was, oh, just, think positively, you'll be fine, that kind of thing. So it was a real lesson for me about the depth and impact of mental health issues. And disability generally, and how I was completely ignorant before, but going through my own experience really helped me to understand what so many other people have been having to deal with without my support even before I went through that. So it was hugely learning experience, humbling. And I absolutely dedicated to trying to turn around these attitudes and perceptions in our world today. And I, if I may end by quoting Martin Luther King.
Yeah, go ahead.
Who said, fly. If you can't fly, run. If you can't run, walk. If you can't walk, then crawl, but you must keep moving forward. And so if the small steps that I can make keep us at least even crawling forward, then that's what I will do.
That's so powerful, Marsha. And I love what you said about mental health as well, because I think it's something like the statistic is 1 in 4 people struggle with mental health and do not speak about it. And I think not the fact that people don't speak about it, some people don't identify that it is mental health. And I think within this Western society that we live in, and a lot of people that are in, say, high positions or jobs that require so much of them, there is bound to be some form of mental health sometimes because of the pressures that are going on. And when you identify and you go through it, you kind of look at everybody else differently. As you said, before you have a different attitude, before you actually experience something yourself. And the same here with myself. I had a totally different attitude and I would probably think, oh, my West Indian upbringing comes up, come on, pull yourself together, get back up, without actually realising the layers beneath the behaviour. And I think when you have a look at the layers beneath the behaviour, and as Carl Jung said, sometimes maybe identifying their so-called shadow self and seeing what is going on for you, then you can start to understand and unpeel those layers and see what it is you need to address, or what's going on for you, what's affecting your behaviour, so you can move forward. So that's really strong. And Martin Luther King quote, amazing. Thank you so much, Marsha. You've really got me thinking, and I feel you probably even got the audience thinking. And I do wish you so much luck with your company, Unheard Voices. I think what you stand for is something that a lot of companies, well, not a lot of companies, most companies and solopreneurs and people need in their lives, just to kind of have a look at their perceptions and to kind of change the way that we view things and we view people. Thank you very much, Marcia. So I just
thank you for inviting me.
Thank you again. And I'd just like to say from Tony the Communication Doctor and from Marcia Ramroop, adios. My takeaway from this show today is that underlined prejudice behind the kind of sentiment can really affect a person to the point that it affected Marcia with regards to her mental health experience, which she did, and I must add, she did overcome through the support that she had from her family and the support that she had through the doctors. But this did not need to happen. Too many times we have this underlying prejudice that happens within the workplace, and it could happen in all sorts of different ways, whether it is to do with race, whether it is to do with feminism, or whether it is to do with body type, whatever. This happens every day, and I find it in my work all the time. And one of my biggest takeaways from this show is that Marcia overcame this through her positivity and through her positive mindset and her passion for diversity. And what came out of this is she set up Unheard Voices, and now she is helping other people to tell their story and to release whatever pain that they are going through. So I suppose what I want to say is, let's try and prevent that underlying prejudice within the workplace or just within society, and that is first of all recognizing that you are actually doing it, or if you recognize that it's happening to you, don't just sit back, speak out, do something about it. Take care.